Mr. Welsh. And over to you.
Afternoon, if you don't mind, I'll stand. I feel That's like fine. I'm sitting at the kiddies' dinner table there. Sir, just an update. You don't see Mr. Hurd sitting next to me. Unfortunately, his family is too unwell for him to attend even by Teams.
Okay.
So my apologies for that inconvenience. His evidence has been filed in advance.
Yes.
And I would simply ask you, sir, to take that as read. If you have any questions, then either pose those to me if I can answer them, but I'm conscious I'm not getting evidence from the bar, or I'll arrange for Mr. Hurd to provide an answer to you separately, sir. So again, my apologies for that.
And certainly, Mr. Welsh, the time we get till tomorrow afternoon, I'll be adjourning, so it will allow that if there were particular questions for him, time for that response that would then go to all parties prior to any right.
Thank you, sir. I don't think we actually wanted him here from the sound of things, so I think we've adopted the best way forward. Now, sir, I thought I tuned in last night, interrupting my Netflix time to listen to the transcript, and there was a fair discussion, and my friend presented some what they described as initial supplementary submissions dealing with a matter raised in my opening submission. Yes. I thought I might just talk to you through those submissions and my response to those, and then come back to my opening submissions that have been filed in
That's
advance.
Fine.
That's all right.
Thank you.
So, first of all, I wish to respond to the initial supplementary submissions of Ms. McIntosh. Dealing with my submissions on the relevance, or more precisely the lack thereof, of the Resource Management Enabling Housing Supply and Other Matters Amendment Act. I'll just call that the Amendment Act, but it's been assumed into the RMA in any event. Ms. McIntosh addressed you on how PC13 evolved and referenced unspecified advice to the applicant provided by Hamilton City Council that PC13 should implement PC12 density standards. That has no bearing on the issues and does not provide any basis whatsoever for reading into clause 25.4a of the first schedule that the MDRS applies to the major facilities zone. At paragraph 4, Ms. McIntosh appears to agree with me that clause 25.4a refers back to section 77G1. Which very clearly is limited to a relevant residential zone. Now, a relevant residential zone, you weren't addressed on this yesterday as far as I could hear, that's defined in section 2 of the RMA, and it quite simply means all residential zones, and then provides some exclusions. It doesn't include a large lot residential zone, an offshore island or settlement zone, among the four exclusions. The short point is that major facilities zone, which is a bespoke zoning in Hamilton, is not a relevant residential zone. Neither are any business, commercial, industrial, or rural zones. They're not relevant, they're not caught by the MDRS legislation. While it appears that the applicant and perhaps Hamilton City sought to align PC13 outcomes on the basis that it was approved in order to be consistent with PC12, that preference does not mean that the PC13 subject site is subject to the MDRS. The applicant, in simple terms, has got well and truly ahead of itself. And I think Dr. Beattie referenced it, is this a chicken and egg situation? Well, no, it's not. There's no chicken here. The subject site is not subject to PC12, or PC12, I should say, does not relate to this area. And the fact that the district plan has medium density residential zone lends no support to this plan change. Patently, on the clear wording of section 77G, the subject site does not fall within the NDRS. I'll talk you through 77G if you don't mind, Mr. Chair. Seventy-seven G, first of all, is entitled the duty of specified territorial authorities to incorporate the NDRS to give effect to policy 3 or 5 in residential zones. So alarm bells sort of immediately rung there that the duty is on the territorial authority, not to private plan change proponents. Subsection 1 reads, every relevant residential zone of a specified authority must have an NDRS incorporated into that zone. As I've explained, this is not a relevant residential zone. Subsection 3, when changing its district plan for the first time to incorporate the NDRS to give effect to policy 3 or 5, meaning that of the NPSUD, as the case requires, and to meet its obligation, it being the territorial authority, a specified territorial authority must use an IPI and the IPSS. This is not the IPI or the ISPP, and obligations do not apply to private landowners. Subsection 4 then carries on that in carrying out its functions under this section, a specified territorial authority may create a new residential zones or amend existing zones. Very clearly, it's a special process that was adopted for councils, specified councils, to follow through, that they must follow through and introduce the NDRS. I strongly disagree with the submission made at paragraph 5 of my friend's supplementary submissions, that this is not material to your consideration of Plan Change 13. It is fundamental that you apply the law correctly and base your decision on the evidence that in turn correctly applies the law. The applicant has elected not to amend its evidence. I also strongly disagree that my open submissions on the issue do not undermine the substantive components of PC 13 under section 32 and section 32AA. In my submission, those assessments are absolutely and fundamentally flawed and deficient. You have been invited to remedy these flaws by backfilling through your own section 32AA evaluation. That is clearly highly unsatisfactory, and any support from the NDRS should not form any part of that analysis. Simply put, the applicant's evidence and the PC 13 provisions, the whole architecture of PC 13, has been predicated on an incorrect assumption that the NDRS applies to Plan Change 13. Your task of unpicking that evidence and determining what is left is a significant challenge for you. A more appropriate response would be to reject the plan change. Ms. McIntosh submits that PC 13 should be considered on its merits. I agree, but that has not been the approach adopted by the applicant in its evidence. The applicant's evidence, especially Mr. Oliver, has taken support from a matter that is not available to it. For example, Mr. Oliver, in his section 32AA assessment, assesses provisions through qualifying matter filter of that qualifying matters filter of section 77L and 77IJ. Those matters relating specifically to the NDRS. Mr. Oliver also rejects submitter relief, for example, in table 3 of his evidence in chief, on the basis that the relief is beyond NDRS. Managing effects of PC 13 is not subject to the limitation of qualifying matters under the NDRS. The applicant and its team has frankly got well ahead of itself and Plan Change 12 for that matter. These are not slight or minor errors. They are fundamental. And I must say, they also are compounded by the applicant's decision not to call any economic analysis or land supply information and assessments. And in my submission, go to the heart of the PC 13 provisions in the applicant's evidence and indeed their legal submissions. Paragraph 8, Ms. McIntosh submits quite remarkably that regardless of the criticisms from Mr. Welsh, this has no relevance to the merits or otherwise of the relief sought by Chartwell Investments and others, and that none of the submitters challenged density. With respect, the density of PC 13 goes to the heart of some of Chartwell's reverse sensitivity concerns. The higher the density, the higher the potential for complaints. The higher the height of dwellings needed to respond to the density aims of the applicant, the less effective, for example, the fencing mitigation will become. The introduction of more sensitive activities, residential dwellings, can, as a matter of logic, only increase the potential for reverse sensitivity effects. While the NPSUD supports residential and business land supply, it's not clear to me how it supports density for which this piece, this plan change is based. Now, Mr. Oliver, in response to questioning, you asked, the panel asked, for a precedent. Has there been a precedent that Mr. Oliver offered you Peacocks? That's not correct. Plan change 5, in paragraph 1 of the decision, so you don't have to read too far, noted that PC 5 seeks to replace the Peacock structure plan with its central residential and special character zone. So that's what the existing zone was, residential, with a new Peacock structure plan, providing, amongst other things, a new MDR zone. The issue that the PC 5 committee were grappling with was in the process of PC 5. The Enabling Act, the Amendment Act, was before the Select Committee, and Hamilton City filed a submission capturing all of what subsequently became the Amendment Act and the MDRS, and submitted that Plan Change 5 should be consistent with that. It's quite a different case, because the Peacocks was already a residential zone, as noted in paragraph 1 of the decision, and it was simply trying to future-proof that. Here, we're not a relevant residential zone. So, in my submission, the reference to the Peacock decision does not assist you at all. At paragraph 92 of Ms. McIntosh's opening submission, she criticises Mr. Holbrook for not providing a Section 32AA analysis of the 60-metre setback, or for not providing an assessment against Section 77I, J, and L. Her criticism of Mr. Holbrook is rather ironic, given the constructive nature of Mr. Holbrook's engagement with the applicant's team to remedy their own sufficient deficiencies in the plan change provisions. Many of the changes to the Plan Change 13, right through to those in the rebuttal statements, are as a result of the submitter's experts identifying errors or flaws in the applicant's assessments or plan drafting. In terms of the 60 metre setback, Mr. Holbrook has included a Section 32AA evaluation in his summary statement, and he can talk to you shortly on that. Ms. McIntosh's criticism in respect of sections 77I, J, and L is specious and highlight a fundamental misapprehension of the law and the relevance of those sections to this application. While PC 13 seeks to facilitate an MDR, medium density residential development, this is not Hamilton City's intensification planning instrument, and PC 13 does not relate, as I've explained, to a relevant residential zone under Section 77G1. uh, This panel is not empaneled to consider the Enabling Act or the MDRS. That is the job of the PC 12 panel. So you can breathe a sigh of relief. And their timeframes for delivering a decision have been pushed out to December 2024. The applicant has elected to press on with PC 13. Coming back to Council's complaint that Mr. Holbrook had failed to undertake the necessary evaluations under Section 77 I, J and L, I note. Section 77 I relates to qualifying matters in applying the medium density residential standards. And as I've explained, they do not apply here. So this is not the forum for evaluating qualifying matters. And it's most certainly not Mr. Holbrook's job to provide planning evidence for a submitter on a private plan change on a matter that does not relate to that request. Section 77J1 reads that this section applies if a territorial authority is amending its district plan. Section 2 continues the evaluation report from the specified territorial authority. Hamilton City Council is amending its plan as provided for in Section 77G through Plan Change 12. The Racing Club is not. Mr. Holbrook is not undertaking an assessment for Hamilton City Council in its IPI capacity. Section 77L provides as a matter is not a qualifying matter in relation to an area unless an evaluation report identifies, justifies and evaluates certain listed matters. Again, this is not the forum for assessing those matters, and Mr. Holbrook has quite rightly not considered irrelevant matters. The criticism of him are entirely misplaced. But in my submission, this highlights the misapprehension of the law by the applicant and its team. While the intention may have been to align PC 13 with PC 12, the reality is PC 13 has now got well ahead of PC 12 by a considerable margin, and depending on the election results, may have got ahead of the legislation itself. By direction number 20, issued on the 8th of August 2023, the independent hearing panel confirmed in PC 12 that the Minister has agreed to Hamilton City Council's request for an extension of PC 12 to 20 December 2024, by which time they have to deliver their decision. Now that may cause some difficulty to the applicant, but it's the applicant's choice to proceed with this plan change. In my submission, PC 12 offers no relevant support to Plan Change 13, including its objectives and policies, which Mr. Oliver notes in his summary evidence at paragraph 9 that he has considered in the context of PC 13 and opined that they have been given effect to in PC 13. They have no relevance whatsoever. just picking up on a couple of other observations from my friend's opening submissions, and then I'll come to mine. The future state of the environment. Counsel for the applicant notes at paragraph 70 that the future state environment requires a real-world analysis. I note that within a real-world lens of a relatively flat site of 6,500 square metres, located centrally within a city with a shortage of industrial land, that an entirely realistic real-world analysis is that Chartwell may, in the future, look to redevelop its site and one of the permitted activities it can undertake in the industrial zone is industrial activities, along with all the effects on sensitive activities that an industrial use will entail. And you've heard from the lay submitters just preceding me of what activities are currently undertaken within this locality. So in my submission, the criticism is misplaced. And I also observed, panel, the rather ironic situation that we had this morning, where we actually saw reverse sensitivity in force through residents of Metlife Care Village who were complaining, or I use that in a non-pejorative sense, about the design and seeking to constrain the design of the development on their doorstep. That was an interesting example of how reverse sensitivity issues start. The no complaints covered, and I want to respond to my friend's opening submissions in respect of that. Ms. McIntosh submits at paragraph 98 that a no complaints covenant would achieve nothing to mitigate the effects in question. The evidential basis for that submission is unclear. Mr. Balbooth, in his rebuttal statement at paragraph 35, acknowledges that a no complaints covenant are useful for setting expectations of incoming residents. And at paragraph 95 of his evidence in chief, he notes that this, being the no complaints covenant, is an additional layer of regulation to address potential noise effects. Ms. McIntosh continues at 98 and again at 99 that there is no evidence to support no complaints covenants to support its necessity in the context of Plan Change 13. Patently, that is factually wrong. Ms. McIntosh might not like the evidence of Chartwell and others, for example, Mr. Jacobs' evidence at paragraph 45 and 60, but there is evidence. Again, at 69, Ms. McIntosh submits that Chartwell and other submitters' concerns are unfounded and not supported in evidence. This is quite wrong and entirely misleading. Ms. McIntosh asserts that no complaint covenants are administratively burdensome for council to enforce. As noted in my opening submissions at paragraph 52, the Environment Court in Combi Properties noted that they do not contravene the principles of the RMA and are enforceable, albeit in a civil jurisdiction and not by the relevant council. Ms. McIntosh opines that no complaints covenants may be an appropriate method in some unspecified specific circumstances, but they're not appropriate here. It's unclear from those opening submissions why, in the context of a plan change that will facilitate circa 200 residential dwellings next to industrial activities, why such covenants are not appropriate. Just you briefly, sir, on the acoustic fence that's been sought by Chartwell and the other submitters that Mr. Lang is acting for. Council for the applicant submits that any extension of the proposed 1.8 metre fence can be considered on a case-by-case basis at the resource consent stage. That submission does not align with the actual provisions of the PC 13 provisions, which in Rule 4.8.12f, which is on page 38 of Mr. Oliver's rebuttal statement attachment 1, given the rule's reference to a 1.8 metre solid fence, not an acoustic fence, I might add, it is unclear how a case-by-case assessment would work in practice. And I think Mr. Holbrook will address you on this from the situation of a processing planner who's looking at the plan rules and it says has to provide a 1.8 metre high fence. I don't see the mechanism by which that could change on a case-by-case basis to a 4 metre acoustic fence. Those matters the processing planner would rightly consider have been addressed through the plan change rules itself. Mr. Jacob, in his evidence, outlines why such an acoustic fence is necessary. Although he disagrees with the need for a 4 metre high acoustic fence, Mr. Balbooth, in his rebuttal, acknowledges at paragraph 32 and 33 that the inclusion of a 4 metre acoustic barrier would reduce the level of noise incident on the facades of the future development within PC 13. Additional height of an acoustic barrier would reduce the degree of sound reduction required by the facade for parts of the building. And finally, sir, I'll just come back to the MDRS and answer the question, so what? Well, really, I've got about six, so what, the consequences. First of all, PC 13 facilitates a development of a scale and a density that has been informed by the MDRS, which doesn't apply. It's been informed, we've been told by Mr. Oliver, by PC 12, the objectives and policies of that plan change, which does not apply here. Mr. Oliver's evidence confirms he has, in PC 13, given effect to those objectives and policies in PC 12. The second reason, Section 32 and the Section 32AA analysis have been prepared through the wrong lens. They have been informed by the MDRS. Or the applicant's expert team have rejected submitter relief on the basis of the MDRS and qualifying matters. It's not a shield in this lane change request. Five. The MPSUD does not require this outcome. While the MPSUD supports residential and business development, it's entirely unclear to me how the applicant arrives at this density through provisions, I think, 3.31 and 3.32 of the MPSUD. Six, this is not a lacuna, as was submitted by my friend yesterday. Parliament clearly envisaged that the NDRS rules clearly and would only apply to the relevant residential zone. They turned their mind to it. They've defined what a relevant residential zone, and it isn't the major facility zone. So the applicant may, if it wants to rely on the NDRS, to go through a two-stage process. The applicant will have to wait until 2025 for the MDRS to be in place anyway. It cannot leapfrog. Six or seven, arguments around the efficiency of the process are misplaced. As I said earlier, this isn't a chicken and egg situation. So though my notes that I prepared last night, I'm sorry they're not all coherent and logical, but I wasn't aware that I was the subject of further submissions until relatively late in the afternoon. Good.
So just on those, Mr. Welsh, can you provide those to Mr. Rice?
Not today, I can't. They are typed, but they're more notes. As you would have heard me fumble over a few words, I need to put them into submissions. But it does bring me to, and I want to address you on one of the process issues that we talked about. So to answer your question, yes, I will endeavour to get you the short version of that tomorrow. I think I'm relatively clear that I can commit to that and try and get it in whilst the panel is still sitting.
Yep. Okay, thank you.
It might be late tomorrow, sir, but I shall do my best. And I just want to, it's an opportune time to just talk about the process that you discussed as a matter of housekeeping at the end of the day with my friend, Ms. McIntosh. And I think probably some of you are thinking aloud rather than having formed a direction around this. But it was envisaged that there would be further changes, you'd done more changes to the plan change, and that you had requested that the applicant engage with the council and get their views on it. The natural consequence of that, sir, is it cuts out the submitters. And from a natural justice perspective, that cannot be what you intended, or shouldn't be what you intended, because the submitters would be entirely removed from that process. So I would counsel you, sir, without overstepping the mark, or trying not to overstep the mark, to reflect on that and to come up with an alternative process that does not cut out those that are directly affected by this plan change, sir.
And Mr. Welsh is also... we still have a wee bit of time to go in the hearing process too. So
yeah, I'm only on my fifth day.
Yes.
So that was an
initial reflection, but yes. I take the point.
Yeah. No, I'm not telling you off, sir. I was just taking the opportunity while I'm on my feet to ask you to reflect on that.
Yep.
Thank you, sir. Just in terms of it's a slightly, I'm sorry, coming to now to my opening submissions. It's a slightly different situation that we've got here. So I just want to clarify who I'm acting for and who are my witnesses, just so the panel is quite clear on that. So these submissions are on behalf of Chartwell Investments. And I, for Chartwell, company evidence has been filed by Mr. David Hill. And in an effort of being constructive and efficient, Chartwell is also relying upon the expert evidence of Mr. Albrock, Hall and Jacob. And that evidence is also relied upon Mr. Lamb's client. So they're joint witnesses, if you may. Chartwell made a submission opposing PC 13. It raised significant concerns regarding the real prospect for reverse sensitivity effects in respect of its property at 11 Ken Brown Drive. which shares its northern boundary with PC 13 site. Sensitivity effects on the current and the future activities on the Chartwell site. Chartwell has, through its planning with this, Mr. Albrook engaged constructively in discussions with the applicant, Mr. Oliver. As a result, changes to some of the PC 13 provisions have been proffered by the applicant. Those changes are welcomed, but they do highlight the deficiencies of PC 13 as notified in addressing reverse sensitivity effects. The agreed changes do not fully address Chartwell's concerns regarding conflict in land use and the inevitable serious and consequential reverse sensitivity effects that will arise. And Mr. Albrook sets out in his evidence those unresolved matters. In my submission at 4, PC 13 enables approximately 200 residential dwellings in close proximity to existing residential activities. It represents the antithesis of sound resource management practice. Despite the belated and frankly hodgepodge, and I used that word deliberately, and I was picked up yesterday, but I used it deliberately, we've got any provisions for our site-specific zone now littered across the operative district plan. I'll set out at 5, and I'll just take that as read through the scope of these submissions and the Chartwell evidence at 6. So if I come to page 3, I set out there background to Chartwell. I don't need to take you through that today in the interest of efficiency, but I explained who the Chartwell wider family is and their significant philanthropic contributing nature of their activities to New Zealand's arts and education sector. I set out that paragraph out page 4, the existing environment. And I take you through what the how you define the existing environment and, like my friend, address the Hawthorne decision. At 14, I note that to understand the future state of the environment, reference to the district plan is required. Rule 9.3 in the activity status table sets out a wide variety of activities that are permitted within the industrial zone, including but not limited to industrial activity, which is in turn defined to include all types, and that's my emphasis, all types of processing, manufacturing, service, and repair activities. And also includes, as it is not limited to, light industrial activity. So the panel's evaluation of the existing environment is therefore not limited to existing activities undertaken on the adjacent sites, but extends to the activities that may be established there in the future. And I make that point simply because some of the experts for the applicants team have looked at, including Mr. Bell Booth, and said, well, oh, there's a pretty low level of noise from some of these activities, adjacent activities, there's no issues here. And that's not the appropriate way to approach the future state of the environment. I set out at paragraph 16, Chartwell's concerns with the plan change. And underlying Chartwell's concerns, I note the fact that the Chartwell site is itself, along with the other industrial activity parcels of land, is a scarce physical resource which needs to be sustainably managed. That is recognised in the district plan. The purpose of the industrial zone at provision 9.1A notes that the industrial land base in the city is a key economic driver for the regional economy. Industrial land in the city represents a finite and valuable resource that needs to be recognised and, I've emphasised, protected. Now then, at 18, explain what protect means. I set out in paragraph 19, which I'll take as read, sir, the various rules and changes that Chartwell 6. And at 21, I set out and distill the key matters that you must be satisfied with in terms of approving or considering Plan Change 13. relevant with that, and that is 21A3, and that's the obligations under section 32, and also giving effect under B, well, under C, sorry, the RPS. We'll come to that shortly. Scope of PC 13, paragraph 24, submitted that PC 13 as notified was deficient in respect to responding to the issue of reverse sensitivity. The post-notification changes to the provisions related a belated effort by the applicant and its team to rectify that situation. However, it should not have been left to the submitters to raise and engage on these important issues. And I just elaborate there at 25, but I'll come to reverse sensitivity. Set out the various definitions that of reverse sensitivity that have been articulated in a variety of courts, including the Environment Court and the High Court, and set out at paragraph 29, the rather, I think it was Mr. Mahinick or Mr. Lang, I forget, noted the definition in the RPS, which is very wide and broad in terms of the approach as to what reverse sensitivity is. And given that it is in the RPS that you must give effect to, I would suggest that that's probably an appropriate starting point for your evaluation on what a reverse sensitivity is. Fundamentally, sir, reverse sensitivity effects arise through poor planning practices by allowing for the conflict of land uses through inappropriate provision of new sensitive activities. And I set out in the next few paragraphs a number of Environment Court decisions, including the strata title decision, which have specifically considered reverse sensitivity effects arising from introducing residential activities into business zones. And I just note in that strata decision, before I move on, it comes back to my future state of the environment, paragraph 31, that the issue in that case, the court articulated, was whether the residential use of the proposed residential units would result in a conflict with industrial or commercial activities lawfully existing or able to establish and operate in that zone. So that's why I spent a wee bit of time explaining to you the need to turn your mind to the permitted activities and not just look at the Charkwell site as an office block and a car park. Now, given the development opportunities at the Charkwell site, the fact that reverse sensitivity is not limited to activities present on the site but extends to future state of the environment is a matter the panel will need to be particularly cognizant of. Now, it's an issue that the applicant's experts have not, in my submission, sufficiently assessed. And I'll give you one example set out there from Mr. Oliver's evidence. At 33, the court in strata title noted that it was satisfied based on the evidence that the existing operations currently operate within the permitted activity rules of the Business 5 zone and are expected to be able to do so in the future. In that case, the court noted that the activities currently operated in the business zone land did not necessarily indicate the kinds or the scale that would operate there in the future. So the court's turning their mind to what could operate on this business land in the future. And importantly, in the context of this hearing, and in particular for Charkwell, the court noted that whilst compliance with district planning provisions would be required, the concern is that if an appeal is granted, the residential units will form part of the legitimate existing environment, and the effects on that environment can be taken into account in the resource consent decision making. So when one of the industrial activities come to apply for a consent, the relevant receiving environment will be the 200 residential dwellings on their doorstep. The court found that the presence of legally authorised residential activities would affect the way in which a consent authority would assess any future applications from local businesses for discretionary consent applications. And we were satisfied that there is real prospect that such applications would be made to allow future development of some businesses. This would impose possible restrictions on the business and additional costs that they would not have appreciated at the time they established in the locality that could disadvantage them compared to competitors in other Business 5 zones not constrained by residential development in the same way. At 36, I note that the court did not place much weight on the fact in that case that there'd be no prior complaints made by residents about the operation of the neighbouring businesses. I set out the relevant quote there. Combi Properties dealt with an appeal involving an application to establish 17 two-storey buildings for a mixture of industrial, residential and office uses into a light industry zone. Consent was declined by the council, and at the heart of the appeal was a dispute as to the potential for reverse sensitivity effects to occur due to the introduction of the residential component into the light industry zone. The court found that the presence of residential activities may constrain the establishment of new activities elsewhere within the zone and could result in the imposition of constraining conditions if consent for an industrial activity is required. Here, Mr. Holbrook's taken you through that pathway as how of how new consents may be required from the, in this industrial zone. At 39, the court noted that regardless of the potential for constraints, the presence of residential activities may lead to complaints. Although a business within the LIZ, that's the light industry zone, cannot expect to be protected from all complaints, consequence of having to respond to the same is that additional time and compliance costs are incurred. The court concluded that complaints would be an impediment to the efficient functioning of industrial activities, even if it does not result in the imposition of constraints on those activities. The court further identified that these additional costs that businesses would not have anticipated when they established. And I set out Mr. Oliver's opinion on this, noting that in his opinion, any concerns need to be based on facts of the site and thereby existing and likely land uses, because anything else would be essentially speculative. And I say in my submission that Mr. Oliver's opinion is entirely misplaced and contrary to the clear Environment Court authorities. Set out in 43 and 44, a brief summary of the foregoing that I've taken them through, and in 46, I talk about the unresolved issues. Just want to mention the no complaints covenant. Principal matter outstanding is the provision of a no complaints covenant to be registered on records of title for new residential lots, should PC 13 be confirmed. The applicant, through the evidence of Messrs. Balbooth and Oliver, recommend against that as a way to avoid or mitigate reverse sensitivity effects. Mr. Balbooth acknowledges that a no complaints covenant are an additional layer of regulation to address potential noise effects, but he considers them from an acoustic perspective that the rules framework is suitable and that such covenants are not 100% effective, as people may still complain irrespective of the covenant. And he notes they're finally, they're difficult to enforce, in his opinion. Mr. Jacob disagrees, and I provide you a precis of those reasons as to why Mr. Jacob disagrees with that. Mr. Oliver addresses no complaint covenants and opines that such covenants are not enforceable by the council, which is axiomatic, such that they are difficult to administer and they are unnecessary. He does not explain why the applicant elected to use such a mechanism to benefit and protect from residential dwellings at Minogue Drive for its own benefit, and why that mechanism is appropriate for the applicant but not its industrial neighbours. Mr. Holbrook notes that in his experience such covenants can be successfully exercised, and he rightly notes they do not require the administration by council to be enforceable. For Chartwell, the registration of a no complaints covenant is a useful and common tool in addressing reverse sensitivity issues. And I'm obliged, Mr. Lang, for foreshadowing how you may, if the applicant remains resistant to the provision of such a matter in the provisions, how you may address the submitter's relief. I endorse that, those submissions. The Environment Court has found that the use of no complaints covenants can further mitigate potential reverse sensitivity effects, even where the distance between the conflicting land use is considered to be sufficient to address reverse sensitivity. And I set out some cases where no complaints covenants were not upheld by the Environment Court. But I note that the Court in Combe Properties considered those decisions and found both were distinguishable on the facts. It did not support the Council's opposition to a no complaints covenant as a tool to manage reverse sensitivity effects as a matter of general principle. Unhelpfully, panel, the Court didn't explain why those two decisions were distinguishable. They just, the judge just noted they were. So when you footnoted at 44 that the Craddock decision involved a poultry farm and the Ngāti Rārā decision was a residential development in proximity to horticultural activities. In both instances, in those cases, the consent was actually declined. So nothing really turned on a no complaints covenant because the developments were both declined on the basis of reverse sensitivity effects, among other things. Set out at 52, the relevant passage from Combe Properties, that appropriately drafted covenant is a private means of reconciling conflict public interest. They do not contravene the principles of the RMA and are enforceable, albeit in a civil jurisdiction and not by the relevant council. There's the authority directly contrary to the evidence in the submissions that have been presented to you by the applicant. The Court noted, and there's a bit of this in my submission with Plan Change 13, the Court noted that it's not prepared to speculate that future residents would necessarily be accepting of a lower level of residential amenity experience within the site. Without the condition proposed by Combe in closing, and that condition panel related to limiting the industrial activities that could be conducted within the multi-use units. The Court noted we find it is not appropriate condition and reverse sensitivities within the site remain an extant issue. So I set out at 53 my submission that no complaints covenants are an appropriate method to protect against reverse sensitivity effects. And I say that the applicant's reasons for rejecting their use are simply specious. And Chartwell invites the applicant to reconsider its position in the use of non-complaints covenants. The activity status, I think these submissions are largely being overtaken by the fact that Mr. Oliver now accepts in his rebuttal statement that he agrees with Mr. Holbrook's recommendation of a non-complying activity status for uses within the, what are we calling it, the setback, the open space, the potential road. I'm not quite sure what this area is, it's pretty uncertain, but within the setback, belatedly we have some acknowledgement that future changes in there would need to go through a non-complying route. Unfortunately, it doesn't seem to be the hook of the policy framework for that. So at the moment, it's unclear how a consent authority would consider that 104D against the relevant objectives and policies where they're still missing. And it's just good planning practice for rules to have a hook back to a policy outcome to which the rule is intended to relate. One of the key issues outstanding is the setback in respect of the width of 30 metres or 60 metres. Mr. Bell Booth resists this on the basis that it would sterilise a significant area of the proposed plan change area and have an adverse impact on the developable area within it. There was no qualification, or quantification I should say, of this impact. And economic viability is not a matter Mr. Bell Booth has qualified himself to comment upon. Mr. Castles, in his rebuttal statement, addresses the provision of a 60 metre setback and he has serious misgivings about the feasibility of developing PC13 if a 16 metre setback were required. And it wouldn't rely or align with the racing club's vision. In response, I note that the additional setback that Chartwell and others are seeking is 30 metres. The racing club's vision is irrelevant to the issue of addressing a conflict of land use. Financial viability is also irrelevant. And it's not the viable marbo of some sort of commercial, you know, we should need to recognise the commercial realities of things. They're not relevant considerations. Mr. Castle has provided no economic analysis to support his financial viability misgivings. Mr. Balbirth does acknowledge, however, that an increase in the setback would potentially reduce the level of noise received at the residential lots within the new zone. Mr. Hallbrook supports a 60 metre setback, as does Mr. Jacobs. And Mr. Jacob principally addresses a matter that was largely absent from the applicant's evidence, which is the effects at nighttime noise. And you've heard from the lay submitters. Their activities can happen at all hours, where sleep, the potential for sleep disturbance, is a very real consequence. 61, I just go through the evidence and comment around the defence. I'll take that as read, if I may, sir. For the avoidance of any doubt, at 63, without resolution of the unresolved issues set out by Mr. Hallbrook, Chartwell's opposition to PC13 remains and seeks that it be declined or rejected. Now, I've put a line, as I'm sitting here, I've put a line through all the next section and take that as read. But in my years of practice, this is what we used to do. We used to get to the planning analysis and go, oh, we've heard all of this, or oh, this is really boring. You'll hear from a boring planner coming up next, he's going to bore you witless, talking through the obs and pops. But the approach to the determining plan changes and resource consents has completely flipped on its head. And the obs and poles are key drivers of an outcome. And here, even more so, because you're required to give effect to the regional policy statement. So I'll keep them crossed out, but I invite you to read them carefully. They're in the evidence of Mr. Crisp and Hallbrook in particular, and there are a number of them. And their directive language, policy INP4, for example, avoiding, you know what avoid means, Supreme Court in King Salman says, do not allow, and minimising. And minimising is also a directive verb. It means to make small to the smallest extent. So I think, you know, we sort of think that minimise is a bit of a weak verb. It's not. Make it to the small extent. So I set those out on page 18 and 19. Section 32 requires an evaluation to the extent to which the objectives are the most appropriate way to achieve the RMA's purpose. And I echo Mr. Lang's submission that I don't know how you're going to do that task yourself under Section 32AA, because you've been deprived of one of the key disciplines that go into a Section 32AA analysis, being the economic analysis in respect of plan changes for land development. So you need to be satisfied that the relevant objectives are the most appropriate way to achieve the RMA's purpose, whether the provisions are the most appropriate way to achieve those objectives. The latter inquiry requires the identification of other reasonably practical options for achieving the objectives. And that's the relevance of some of the evidence you've heard this morning in respect of other uses for the site. And the assessment of efficiency and effectiveness of the provisions in achieving the objectives. Assessment of efficiency and effectiveness in turn requires assessment of the benefits and the costs of the anticipated effects, including the opportunities for growth and employment and the assessment of acting, of risk of acting or not acting. And I just note there, for want of to flog a dead horse, that the applicant has prepared a section 32 and the 32AA report, which has addressed some but not all of the post-notification changes, and it's elected to do so without any benefit of expert economic analysis or land supply analysis to assess PC 13 through the necessary section 32 filters. Mr. Oliver, about 68, Mr. Oliver argues at paragraph 122 of his evidence that land supply analysis is not necessary due to the NPSUD, not quite sure how he arrived at that conclusion, or because of the RMA Enabling Housing Supply and Other Matters Amendment Act. Patently, in respect of the Enabling Act, that's patently wrong and incorrect. And I'd say my submission, the NPSUD, does not short-circuit a Section 32 report or exempt in any way residential development from adhering to the requirements of Section 32 or Section 32AA. Without such analysis, those evaluations are fundamentally deficient. How are you, as the panel, to be satisfied based on expert evidence that the proposal is the most appropriate way to achieve the purposes of the Act? What are the other reasonably practical options, and what's the efficiency of those provisions and the costs that are anticipated? Sorry, I'm still getting over my COVID, which hasten to add, I didn't realise that was getting put on the website for the world to see that that I had finally caught that, but anyway. So at 70 and 71, I take you in 72, I take you through, which I've already canvassed now, so I'm going to try and save my voice and note that Chartwell remains, in my principal submission, Chartwell remains opposed to PC 13. It seeks it rejected unless the modifications proposed by Monsieur Holbrook Hall and Jacob are adopted. Chartwell's strong preference is to provide mechanisms to manage reverse sensitivity effects before they arise by proactively avoiding and appropriately managing the conflict of land use. And no, sir, and apologies for the time I've taken off the panel. Those are my submissions, sir.
Okay, thanks, Mr. Welsh. Now, we do have some questions of you, and we have yet to hear from your three witnesses. The original intent was that we would complete hearing from all submitters and witnesses, and then adjourn for lunch and then go on our site visit. It's now close to 2:10. It's unfair on my colleagues and those in the room just to carry on, because I suspect we will probably, and it's not rushing your witnesses, Mr. Welsh, but I suspect we've probably got another hour 15, hour 20, depending on questions that we may have.
Look, so that's very useful. I have a 3:00 meeting at the airport, which I will postpone and give my apologies to. So I entirely agree that we should, well, this process shouldn't be rushed.
Yeah.
It is where we are. I have about 6 months supply in terms of not having lunch, but other people in this room don't have that benefit.
Yes.
Or not. Yes. So, sir, taking lunch sounds good.
Okay. So, Steve, we'll need to postpone our, or delay our arrangements for the site visit. Still keen, all going well, to do that later this afternoon, but we can talk about that in the adjournment. So we will adjourn now, and what are we? If we reconvened at say 2:55, and then I'll come back to you, Mr. Welsh,
for questions.
Your
thank
questions,
you,
and then witnesses, and then we'll go through and complete things for this afternoon.
I should just foreshadow, they have each prepared summary statements and addressed some matters from the reply evidence. I've given them some instructions to try and be as efficient, which I didn't follow myself, but to try and be as efficient as they can as they go through the summary, sir.
Yeah. Thank you for that. And in addition, we may have questions of each of the witnesses.
Yeah, absolutely, sir.
So we'll adjourn until 2:55 and then carry on and complete today's hearing schedule.
Thank you, panel.
Thank you.